Hello and welcome to the Majlis podcast, Radio Free of Radio Liberty's current affairs talk show focusing on Central Asia. I'm Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis and Radio Free of Radio Liberty's media manager here in Washington, D.C. It's been more than 2 years since ISIS lost its last physical stronghold in Raqqa, Syria. With this, thousands of ISIS foreign fighters, along with their wives and children, have remained in limbo, mostly in Iraqi custody or in Kurdish detention facilities in northern Syria. Those fighters have come from various countries, and many countries do not want to see those people come back home. However, Kazakhstan decided to look the other way and repatriated hundreds of its citizens from the Middle East. Since then, while some of the fighters were put in jail, their children and wives have been placed in rigorous rehabilitation and de-radicalization programs. In the fresh documentary just released by Radio Free Radio Liberty's Kazakh service, journalist Shahida Toligonova and her crew revisit some of the critical questions about Kazakhstan's repatriation process and its success and failures. So in this episode of the Majlis podcast, we decided to look into what happens once those fighters return to Kazakhstan and how the whole project has been going so far. To discuss all these, I'm joined by Dr. Vera Mironova, a research fellow at the Harvard University and the author of the award-winning book, From Freedom Fighters to Jihadist Non-State Armed Groups Human Resources. She personally interviewed hundreds of ISIS and Al-Qaeda fighters. Shahida Toligonova is with us, who's the award-winning documentary filmmaker and the author of The Second Chance, the documentary, which is the subject of our discussion today. And Bruce Panier, the editor of Radio Free Radio Liberty Central Asia Blog, Kishlok Owasi. Thank you, colleagues, and welcome on board. So, Shahida, congratulations on the completion of another terrific project. So, why not you kick in and start the conversation by telling us about the project and perhaps some of your main findings in that?
The reason I wanted to make this film is that a lot of conversation, a lot of videos and reports have been made on the subject of returning ISIS members, especially women and children, and along with Kazakhstan, some other Central Asian countries like Uzbekistan and Kyrgyzstan taking their citizen back, Russia did, and a few other countries. And the Western governments, meaning the United States and Britain and France and Australia, are very, very reluctant to do so. So it was interesting for me not only to listen to the stories of women who came back home to Kazakhstan, but also talk to the people who worked with them, like the imams, the theologists, the psychologists, who went through this whole mind-blowing transformation, because these people, unlike the returnees, the former ISIS members, theologists and psychologists has never seen the war. They never been challenged or faced with extreme ideologies like that. And it was interesting to see how they viewed these people from the point of their arrival back to Kazakhstan 2 years on, and talk about the successes and perhaps failures of this quite unprecedented program of rehabilitation of ISIS returnees.
Now, these are terrific details that you're talking about, Shahida. We are going to get to this. First, just some factual data from the documentary you presented. So the number we are talking about here is around 500 people, right? The ones who are repatriated.
Well, 500 people plus minus from the first. The operation took part. There was six or five stages of the operation repatriation. First one happened in January 2019, and then in spring 2019, that's when about 500 people were taken back. After that, there were another three stages of this special operation to return people, and the whole thing was completed in February this year. At this point, the Kazakh government said that, well, practically we took everyone who wanted to be taken home, and that's pretty much it. However, I do suspect, and I think Dr. Mironov will know more details about that, that there are some other Kazakh children still in the camp in Al-Hol, in Kurdish-controlled areas. And probably, I believe that Kazakh government will still try to get these children back home, because again, as the advisor to the president of Kazakhstan, Ilan Karin, pointed out, the main reason Kazakhstan took these people back is for the sake of children. You know, because children have no, they're not to blame what their parents did. It's extremely unfair to keep them in these horrific conditions. They've already been traumatized by the scenes of war. They're traumatized even more by living in the camp. And that was one of the main reasons the Kazakh government decided to bring these people back.
And of course, as it is shown in the documentary, that most of those people who were repatriated were female and children, and there were also some grown-ups, right?
Yeah, there were some men as well, but I think most of them are in the prisons.
Hmm.
It's very difficult to understand what these people's role in the Islamic State was. I mean, I think with the, in the case of men, it's pretty much straightforward. They probably, most of them were fighters or participated in some sort of armed activity. But with women, we don't know, because most of them claim that they've been just housewives, but sitting at home, raising children, this, that. How do you verify if they're saying truth or not? Because the narrative of the stories is the same. I followed my husband. And actually, in the course of this film, I met only one woman. She's not part of the film. Who went to join the Islamic State in actually in mid-2016, when things are quite rough over there.
Mm-hmm.
She went willingly herself, you know, without husband, without anything. And she really was committed to the ideas of so-called caliphate.
Mm. You know, that kind of brings two questions across my mind, Shahida. First is how they are treated once they are back in Kazakhstan, in terms of how they differentiate between one person to the other in terms of the process forward. But that I will come back in a minute. But before that, let me bring in Dr. Minruba. The other leg of the question that I wanted to raise from the comments just made by Shahida is, so the categories in which those people are selected in Syria to be brought back into Kazakhstan, like what Shahida is saying, like, you know, first of all, of course, you know, the determination, I guess, this is my own commentary here, I guess it starts from Syria when they are being picked up by the Kazakh authorities, I guess, or maybe there are some mediators, I don't know. Please also enlighten us if there's any insight you have on that kind of a selection process there. So how they determine who should be brought back to Kazakhstan?
As far as I know, Kazakhstan took everyone they were able to take who are Kazakh citizens. On the other side, there are still several families who managed to escape, first. And second, there are, as far as I know, two extended families who are still in a camp. Because when Kazakhstan was taking their citizens, they managed to hide. Very unpleasant people, you know, to be fair. They were involved in some problems in the camp. That's how we learned about that.
How many people are still there? I mean, as you said in earlier, Shahida also mentioned that. I mean, Kazakh authorities say they brought back anyone from Kazakhstan who wanted to come back, right? If that is the situation. So how many people we think are still there in Syria from Kazakhstan?
I was able to count two families in Syria or in a camp.
In,
you know, those are two different questions. In a Kurdish custody, I managed to count two families. So one has something like three adults and five kids. And the second one is also around five people.
So we also expect that there might be people who are not in those camps?
Well, absolutely. I mean, first of all, there are still Kazakh citizens fighting in the Idlib area. And also there are Kazakh ISIS members who managed to escape from Kurdish-controlled territories to Idlib and, you know, maybe even to Turkey now.
Mm-hmm. Why do they escape?
Well, because they don't want to go home. They don't, either they are too radical to even consider, you know, coming back from terrible non-Muslim country, according to them.
Mm.
Or they just, you know, they just simply think that they would be imprisoned and home and they don't want to do that.
As you said, you met a couple of them in the camps. So what was your own impression after meeting those people? What kind of feelings you came out of those meetings?
Well, I'm in communication with a lot of people, Russian-speaking former USSR folks in those camps. And, you know, what is my impression? I mean, first of all, the ISIS members of ISIS. What impression can you possibly have from members of ISIS? Are they still supporting ISIS? Some of them do and some don't. It's different. But, you know, if you go there, those who do, they throw stones at you, you know, call you different bad names. Very unpleasant place to be in to start with.
Wow, very interesting. We are talking about Kazakhstan today, but along with Kazakhstan, we have also seen earlier Uzbekistan bringing back some of its citizens from Iraq and Syria. And I guess Tajikistan also started. In fact, Tajikistan started with repatriating minors from Iraq. So how the Kazakh case is kind of compared with those countries?
Kazakhstan took everyone they could take, right?
Hmm.
Then Uzbekistan, as far as I know, took overwhelming majority. I know there's some Uzbeks left. But also keep in mind that women in camps hide their citizenship. So, for example, you know, she could say if she has double citizenship with, you know, Uzbekistan and Russia or Uzbekistan and Kyrgyzstan, she would play whatever citizenship suits her well, right? So we are not talking about those people. So Uzbekistan took a lot. Tajikistan did not take any female members yet. So they only repatriated kids from Baghdad prison. It's a very different story. We could not mix them together. So and approaches here are very different. So while Kazakhstan put in prison at least some female members of ISIS, I think like something like 15 they imprisoned. Uzbekistan did not imprison even one female member of ISIS, which, you know, is ridiculous, right? And we know that there were Uzbek women who were keeping slaves. We know that there were Uzbek women who were participating in fighting units. ISIS had two female fighting units, Naisha and Nuseiba. So we know that there were Uzbek citizens there. We know that female Uzbekistan citizens were working for AMIA, which is, you know, ISIS internal intelligence. So, you know, there are obvious questions like why those people are not in prison. And in many cases, they're even given benefit, free housing, free medical, you know, some kind of other cash payments.
What's the logic?
ISIS members.
What's the logic?
And Tajikistan. Wait, and Tajikistan went a different route. So, for example, Tajikistan did not repatriate any female member yet because their intelligence services are working in preparation of individual cases. You know, because it takes time. You could not just bring them in a country and let them go, like, for example, Uzbekistan did, right? So, you know, they are preparing to repatriate them, but when they are ready, with a file for each of them.
Interesting. I think you were surprised by some of the way they are treating these people. What's the logic behind the way Uzbekistan is treating, especially the, you said, none of the female returnees are placed in jail?
Well, technically, they're claiming that, oh, they're poor women, you know, brought there by their husband, they're innocent, which, you know, is not true. So I think it's a decision made by someone up in the government, and no one could say, basically, guys, what are you doing? So that's a big problem. You know, they're going to realize sooner or later when someone does something. And already we could see that a lot of money is to fund terrorist organizations, right, in Afghanistan and Syria. They are facilitated by women who are returned. And I know for a fact that some of that is facilitated by women returned to Uzbekistan.
Wow. You know, there are...
So not only they're not prosecuted for their previous crimes they did in Syria, right, but also... Like right now, they still continue doing what they were doing.
Very
dangerous.
Very interesting. Bruce, so I'm faced with a sea of information here. So please help me to treat the brain of our guest speakers today. And also in the meantime, Bruce, you know, we are sort of drawing comparison between Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, and Tajikistan. So what do you see standing out here to you?
You know, obviously, there's some different approaches. As Dr. Mironova said, that, you know, the Tajiks haven't brought back any adults at all. And you know, generally, not many men have come back, young men have come back for obvious reasons, I think, too. Kyrgyzstan, of course, has taken some back with a lot of help. They got some of their citizens back, too. You know, the thing that always struck me about this, and I'm hoping either Dr. Mironova or Shahida can help me out with this, too. I like the film about Shahida did with the Kazakh service, because that was the first time I got to see what happens to these people. You know, when they just arrive, they make there's all kinds of publicity when they actually evacuate them and bring them back home. And then there's a lot of talk about what's going to happen to them, how they're going to try to help some of them maybe get jobs or housing and things like that. And then they just seem to fall off the radar entirely. And you're not really sure whatever happened to them 5 months or a year after they've come back home. But you'd think there's something out there, you know, saying, here's somebody, you know, she in the film that the Kazakh service and Shahida did, there's the woman that works at the restaurant, owns it. You know, you'd think there'd be success stories like that all over Central Asia, where they've repatriated. But here's someone who we brought back, you know, who understood it was a huge mistake.
Yeah.
And they make themselves into something and help the country out, you know, and they fit in again at home. You know, that would be like the natural happy end to the story of evacuating them to begin with. But you never get that part.
You brought us, Bruce,
to a... Step in here for a second, just to add up to what Bruce said. Sorry, Mohammed.
Yeah.
Actually, it's a very good point, Bruce, because it's not a Hollywood happy end story, right? Because while I was there filming with these girls, there were two women who didn't want to be part of the film, who came and were extremely aggressive and really extremely unpleasant, started demanding money for the interview. And I said, no, I don't give normally money for the interview. Anyway, I said, well, if you don't want to be filmed, it's fine, of course. And then I was sitting down and talking to one of them. She was Russian and she was quite young. And she started saying something. I was like, look, I've been to those parts of Turkey. You know, I know what you're talking about. She was like, oh, it's good to talk to someone who knows. And then she started describing to me how wonderful life in the Islamic State was, that they had everything and everything was great, the house, and she lived, it sounded like she lived like a queen. And she actually ran away from Kazakhstan. She's from the city of Uralsk. She ran away at the age of 18 because she on the internet met some Chechen guy who was waiting for her there. Anyway, it doesn't matter. So cut the story short, she is the case which I consider is a lost case. This woman came back. Yes, she went to rehab. I spoke to the person who was working with her, like a psychologist and theologist. And they also admitted that she's like, she just pretends that she's changing. She's not. She's still extremely committed to the ideology of ISIS. And this is very important to note that probably the women who you saw in the film, unfortunately, probably at best will be 50% of those returnees who actually decided to start a new life and forget what happened. The rest are so brainwashed that they will be committed to this ideology forever.
Wow. So you are saying, like, you know, the people that you met so far, or the 500 figure that you give Shahida in the film. So you are saying, like, somewhat half of those people are still believe that what they did was the right thing?
There was out of this 500, or now it's almost 700 people returned to Kazakhstan. The vast majority are children, over 400. We have to bear it in mind. So when we're talking about the grown-ups, the adults, we probably talk about like 30%. In terms of the numbers, the women plus minus about 200 and something. They're across Kazakhstan, and I believe the Kazakh authorities do keep an eye on them through this Akhmiyat, this public foundation for awareness, and they have to go with this psychologist, and specialists have to go and visit these women. But equally, I've heard that in other areas, like, for example, in Aktau, there are issues with these communities of returned women who just don't want to get back into the society. They are quite happy in their ISIS bubble, and that's it, you know. And so, what do you do with these people?
So these are the people, Shahida, that the ones you are referencing to are the ones who have gone through all these rehabilitation process that government is running, right?
Yes, they all had to. They all, upon arrival, were placed to this special camp. It's actually a resort in this, on the seaside. So they all had to go through compulsory 1 month plus minus rehab program. But the problem is that 1 month is not enough. These people live with this ideology for several years. Imagine how much brainwashed you are. Like, you know, so to get them out and open their eyes and to the different interpretation of Islam is extremely difficult. And as theologists or imams who are working with them do realize that they were not fully equipped. They were preparing, but they were not prepared to face what they actually had to face. And they readjusted very quickly. And actually, I think the Kazakhstan's case could be a very good example for other countries to draw lessons from on how to deal with these people. Again, it's not going to be a happy end story. These people are dangerous, as Dr. Mironova was saying. Some of them are extremely dangerous. And going back to Uzbekistan, it's extremely worrying that the government decided just to let them go free. In a country which is already, we saw the tendencies for more conservative Islam, let's put it this way, I'm not calling it radicalization, given the fact that there are so many Uzbeks actually willingly left to join Al-Qaeda and later on to ISIS and Jabhat al-Nusra. And they're still fighting there in Idlib, like Dr. Minoron was saying. Mm-hmm. We have Afghanistan next door, and look at the advances Taliban is making to the Uzbek and Central Asian borders, let's put it this way. If I was in the government of Uzbekistan, especially in the National Security Service, I would have been extremely worried about that. But the approach they took now is very counterproductive, very ill thought through, I'd say.
Mm. Wow. But what, Shaida, you are saying, and this raises another very, I guess, very important, relevant question about what happens really in these rehabilitation centers that Kazakh authorities come to Washington and keeps bragging about the success of those centers there. I mean, what happens there? How effective this whole project is? And also, what comes next for those people who are out of those facilities? And what lies ahead for those who have been taken to jail and placed in jail? So let's continue the conversation talking about these and many other questions very shortly. First, let me recap the debate. Today on the Image Leads podcast, I'm joined by Dr. Vera Mironova, a research fellow at the Harvard University and the author of the award-winning book From Freedom Fighter to Jihadist, Non-State Armed Groups, Human Resources. Shahida Tuliganova, award-winning documentary filmmaker and the author of The Second Chance, the documentary that we are talking about today. And Bruce Panier, the editor of Radio Free Pre-Do Liberty, Central Asia Blog, Kishlok Owazi. I'm Mohammed Tahir, host of the Image Leads podcast here in Washington, D.C., and we are discussing ISIS returnees to Kazakhstan. So the rehabilitation, perhaps feel free, Dr. Mironova or Shahida, whoever wants to jump in here, the rehabilitation centers of Kazakhstan, what really happens there?
Well, no one quite knows what's going on there because those governments, after, as you mentioned, proudly reporting that they care about their citizens and they took them home, after that, everything goes quiet and there is no access, nothing. Only, you know, government officials reporting that, you know, everything is successful and everyone is now, you know, happy living peacefully together with each other. Well, I think what happens actually happens is that the government realized that those people are not as nice and lovely as they thought they are after bringing them home. And now they are not allowing access to them because, you know, it would look bad. For example, Tajikistan openly, which is weird, right? Tajikistan, they put their statistics and information open about it. They're open about it. They said that they had around 100 people who self-returned, right? Those are people who went to Syria and then they surrendered to the embassy, let's say, in Turkey and were repatriated. Out of them, a lot of them got amnesty in the beginning because Tajikistan was also thinking the same way as Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan. But then in 2 years after that, half of those people were rearrested again, imagine. But not for the crimes they did before, but what they kept doing. So recruitment, collecting money for those fighting and so on. So now Tajik government said, you know what, done playing with that. Everyone comes in, no more, you know, pictures with flowers. We already got burned. We prepare cases. At least half of those women goes to prison for a long time. Membership in a terrorist organization, which actually everyone has to go, you know, to prison for. Then recruitment, money, support, fighting, a very long list. So that's what they're doing now. They're preparing for repatriation and not just, you know, whatever the leader of the nation said, we're bringing our citizens home.
Yeah, it looks like Tajikistan is playing hard now. But, you know, one another country which is playing even harder is Turkmenistan. I guess we just don't know anything about the program plans that Turkmenistan might have for people who might have joined ISIS in Syria and what's going on with those Turkmens there. Shahida, earlier you brought up this thing, I mean, in terms of the rehabilitation centers. So you said there are psychologists involved in this. There are mullahs. Who are the stakeholders in this entire operation? What are their roles there throughout this process of rehabilitating those people?
Right, because I've never been inside one. I can't really say for certain. I can only report from the words of the people who've been there, meaning that psychologists and the imams and the people who were taken through the rehab process themselves, meaning the women and children. So the first thing which was done there is to check everyone's health situation. Because as you know, they've been through quite unhygienic conditions and therefore they all have to be checked. So checked and kids had to be vaccinated and et cetera, because at the end of the day, no matter what kind of disease they're going to bring, it's going to infect, you know, other people outside the camp, right? So this was done. A few people came injured, so they had to be operated and injuries had to be treated, et cetera, et cetera. And right after, the question answer. I assume they were questioned by the Kazakh Secret Service, of course, but equally the, you know, imam started lectures on Hanafi Islam, you know, like traditional Central Asian way of keeping the religion. So yeah, and also then the psychologist joined. The sessions were quite intense. A lot of people originally, and I spoke to several imams, unfortunately the film you have only one or two, but I spoke to few, and they all said it was extremely difficult because initially the women didn't want to accept whatever they were saying. There was a wall, a total wall. And first of all, they felt uncomfortable facing a man because they were all coming from some sort of caliphate where they were not supposed to see men outside of their house. Secondly, they thought that they're so advanced in their understanding of the religion because they went and there was a certain degree of arrogance, you know, because they actually were trying to build the state, man, you know, they all went to Hijrah. So one actually theologist, imam, said to me, it was so hard. And then we sat down, all the theologists, and to think what to do. And then we thought to approach it from a different point of view. And he was quite, you know, not a young man. He said, I started telling them, look, I'm like your brother. You came home. I don't really want anything from you. Just, you know, I'm your brother and your sister. Some of them, even though in the camp they were provided with clothes and food and etc., imams themselves on their own money started trying to bring some toys for kids, some books, certain little things to make people. Gradually, the trust was established. So it's not just immediate process. It took some time. And that's why I do appreciate this honesty of people I spoke to on the other side of rehab, that they admit how difficult it was for them to comprehend. First of all, the ignorance in Islam of these people to start with. And secondly, the stubbornness and belief that they know the best. And so 2 years on, and I could see the rapport between the women, especially those who are in the film, and imams, the men they see for lectures. It's genuine. You can't fake it. You know, I'm a pretty experienced person. I know when people fake when they don't. And I can see that there is already relationship and trust between the two sides. And this is the most important thing, which the case of women in the film, because of rehabilitation process, managed to succeed in.
So regardless of the outcome, rehabilitation process of an individual has to end in 1 month. Is it the way it works?
Well, the extreme, yes, 1 month, and then they're allowed to go home. So yeah, and then they're being monitored by a variety of
How does that happen?
They home visits. The ones who are under radar, I mean, those who are like suspected to be more radical than others, they mainly allowed only to be in Nur Sultan, in the capital, under the close eye of the National Security Service. The rest are being kept out by the local former KGB people, as well as they have visits of the theologists and psychologists. They have to come to lectures at least once a week. But many of them actually started working, you know. I mean, they don't sit at home. I mean, I heard a lot of stories that women work. Even actually one woman who is quite radical and extremely unpleasant, somebody who I thought that should belong to the prison rather than to go free, even she was working as a waitress in a restaurant. A Muslim restaurant, I mean, like a halal restaurant, but still.
Yeah, I don't know if you had the chance to speak to her co-workers there, or perhaps neighbors of those people. I mean, how do they look to those people?
It was very difficult. And I deliberately didn't want to speak to the neighbors and etc. because a lot of neighbors and people don't know this women were traveled to the Islamic State and lived somewhere else. And they don't really want, initially when they arrived to Kazakhstan, they're quite open. They spoke to media. They wanted people to like them back because they felt people looking at public is looking at them as traitors, which I don't know. I mean, I'm not judging anyone. So they wanted to tell the story of how mistreated and how misguided they were. Now, 2 years on, after they received a lot of negative press locally, they're shy from media and they don't want people to know where they were because also all of them have children and their children go to kindergartens and to schools. A lot of children are fatherless because, remember, some of the women were married two or three times, and every time their husband died of whatever reason, she becomes pregnant, she delivers a child. They don't want it. You know, so for the sake of children and for the sake of themselves, they want less people to know that where they were as possible. Maybe the relatives might know, but not the general public.
Very interesting. You know, I recall, in fact, the conversation I and a couple of other people had when the Kazakh justice minister was in Washington, D.C. to tell the stories of their repatriation. So he was saying, like, I thought it was a smart idea, that he was saying that the kids who were born in Syria, they started issuing certificates indicating that those kids were born in some town, in some city in Kazakhstan, so that they don't live with the stigma of being a kid who was born under these circumstances. I thought this was interesting. So, Bruce, I don't also like to keep you away from the microphone. Please jump in. As I said, we have a lot to learn from our colleagues here. So any contribution you could make into the in terms of the question, I would really appreciate that. So about the other thing, Shahida, so how the authorities are evaluating the success or the failure of the process, the rehabilitation process? I mean, as I can understand from your comments and also Dr. Minruba's comment, there are lots of fault lines there.
Yeah, but I don't think that anyone ever faced this situation before. This is an unprecedented situation, and there is no a blueprint, like a recipe, a treatment plan designed by the World Bank or any other organization. It's something new. Every country has to go through and, you know, figure out how to deal with these people separately. And I think Kazakhstan did an amazing thing. It was quite a courageous step, I would say, to bring all these people back and work with them. Yes, they're learning along. They're changing things. How do we evaluate success? I don't know. I think it's too early to predict. But I think Dr. Mironova is in a better position to talk about it than I do. I am.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Mironova? Yeah.
Well, I think that Kazakhstan government did a great thing by bringing them home, right? The first country to do so. I mean, absolutely. But the question is what to do with them now. So, and not only with them, because, for example, another concern when we're talking about those ISIS members were not prosecuted and not in prison, right? At least for some time, is the problem that what signal do we send? Do we, in Kazakhstan, for example, send a signal that it's totally fine to go to, you know, to be a member of a terrorist organization, then claim that, oh my God, like I'm this defenseless woman that who follows whoever tells me, you know, whatever they tell me to do, to go, and then, you know, not face consequences in a worst case scenario, and in the best case scenario, even get some benefits, you know, like some startup fund to start business. What signal are we sending to others? And I know that it was already a problem in Uzbekistan. In Uzbekistan, some people, like regular people, they already raised questions why those women were brought back. First of all, they were brought back by the money of the state, right? They flew them home, and now they gave them all those benefits, while we have a lot of people in the country who are poor. And they didn't go anywhere. And, you know, they also need that help. So why those women are getting this preferential treatment? And, you know, then some people are getting arrested, let's say, in Uzbekistan for some small issues, right? Like, we're not even talking about democracy problems in many of those states, right? But just minor issues. So the question that they're asking is why in Uzbekistan or Kazakhstan you go to prison, for example, if they find some kind of radical lectures on your cell phone. Well, you could basically go to ISIS, live there for 4 years, you know, fighting and, you know, participating in all those bad things, and then come back home, and government would even protect you so you are not stigmatized. And I think it's more dangerous in general than actual fate of those, you know, let's say even 100 women.
I'm kind of speechless in how to respond to your argument here, Dr. Mirrobay. Very, very logical point there. I mean, also, I wonder if there has to be a way to reintegrate them into the society, right? In some ways, since you brought them back from Syria with the promise that they will be reintegrated to the society. I mean, is it a solution to put them all of them in jail then?
Well, it's not a long-term solution. I agree with you. It's not a long-term solution. But let's take the example of, like, for example, United States and Tajikistan. Tajikistan is going the way United States is going. So the position of United States, we are taking everyone home, and they did take, and only according to law, you know, no feelings, no talking about, oh my God, I'm a poor woman, what can I do when husband tells me, you know, to go kill myself. You know, there is law. Adult members go to prison for membership in terrorist organization, for things they did there, and, you know, all that. Then, at the same time, their kids go to either foster care or relative if it's confirmed that their relatives are okay. Because keep in mind, those countries, they did not separate. Tajikistan and Uzbekistan did not separate kids from their mothers when they brought them back. And again, mothers are the ones who radicalize kids. Just think about it. You know, we take kids in a foster care. If mother endangers her child, for example, leaving him, let's say, in a car, right? And some that she loses custody of the child right away. And here we have a case when a mother took her kids to a war zone, where it's clear that a kid older than 12 goes to the military training and then joins the military. I mean, come on, isn't it a clear case of endangering a child, you know, as clear as it could possibly humanly get? So in that case, what U.S. does, the individual person, you know, adult member goes to prison. Kids go to foster care because they need to be separated from those absolutely, you know, not mothers who already put them in prison. You know, it's not that we're thinking, oh, my God, like she's into ISIS, so maybe she's dangerous. No, we have a case. You know, she brought him to the war zone. So at that time, while man or woman is in prison, first of all, they actually understand that maybe they did something wrong, right? And the trial is very public, so everyone, you know, could see that basically you should not go to ISIS, right, or any other terrorist organization, because you would face consequences, go to prison. And then after they are released, then we do reassessment, right, and think, did she change? Would she be a danger to her kids, or the kids could be returned to her? This is the way U.S. went. You know, that's how it's done here in America. And by the way, that's how it's now done in Tajikistan. All those kids, they brought around 80 kids from Baghdad. Women there are in prison and they would be there, let's say, forever. So they brought those kids, and Tajikistan says, when I asked them, I was like, okay, so did you give it to grandparents? And they were like, yeah, we wish. But the problem is that when we did assessment of those grandparents or whatever, sisters, you know, close relatives, we found out that half of them are actually also very much into ISIS. They just, you know, failed to go themselves. So we could not give those kids there. So the kids are now in a foster care.
Since you brought up Tajikistan, you know, it's interesting what you are saying. You know, Tajikistan's name doesn't often come up in such a way where this country can be stated as an example of how to do something right, you know, given the painful ground realities on so many levels in the country. But what are the evidence that Tajikistan's heavy-handed approach is, in fact, effective? I mean, how do we know this approach is indeed working when it's compared with the other countries in Central Asia?
Oh, first of all, I would say that Tajikistan is very open. Like, I would say it's the first, when I asked all the countries in the region to send me actual statistics about how many they brought in kids, you know, rearrested case trials, they were the first to respond. So they gave me all the statistics about how many people amnestied, how many people rearrested with types of sentences and so on. So, no, I don't. I think in that case, I know that Tajikistan has some problems, right? But in that case, I think they're pretty open. I was surprised. If this issue is successful and it works in Tajikistan, well, we, first of all, would not see for quite some time, right? But I think it does. Like, at least it's according to law, right? That what they do is according to law. So people know that they should not be going to some kind of shady terrorist organizations because, you know, you get to prison. You don't want to do that, right? And yeah, kids are now in a foster care and in a government. And as far as I know, conditions are quite okay. You know, just a regular foster home, nothing special for ISIS members, right? And also, but also they raised the question with one particular kid. I think he's like 12 or 14, and they said that they had a problem with him because being 12 and 14, and he was placed in this orphanage, and he started like ruling it. He's saying, oh my God, like I'm a great mujahid, and you all have to follow me. And, you know, I went to Syria, and you're all kids and nothing, so come follow me. So they have to rehouse him.
Yeah,
so they're very open about those problems.
Yeah, well, openness might be something, but you know, it's a very complicated picture out there. I have perhaps nothing to say otherwise in terms of the points you are making about the specific approach, but you know, we know any type of religious devotion or religious activity can put you in trouble in Tajikistan. We know how the authorities are using this as a pretext to persecute people. What I'm saying is, generally speaking, Tajikistan's chart is is very complicated on this matter.
No. I totally agree with you, and I don't comment on that. But, you know, maybe, you know, you should not put people in prison for, you know, having Quran or something like that, right? Yeah. But, I mean, membership in a terrorism organization? By the way, every country we're talking about signed a UN memorandum that, you know, they how to deal with those returned foreign fighters. And they all signed a memorandum saying that it's a crime to join ISIS, right? And, you know, they ratified it at home. They just, other countries just not following through with that.
Right. Terrific. Thank you, Dr. Mironova. Very insightful. Bruce, you know, though we need to wrap up the discussion very soon here, I'm just looking into some of my own final points. Oh, yeah. We also wanted to talk about the fundamental issues that triggered the mobilization of many of those people in the first place to the Middle East, whether anything is done on that front. I mean, bringing these people back and trying to, you know, solve this problem through humane way of rehabilitation efforts by Central Asian authorities, while most countries on earth look the other way, are very applaudable effort and deserving praise. But if this problem was to be resolved, those fundamental issues also need to be tackled. Bruce, I guess my question expanded, you know, just to make a long story short, whether the authorities learned a lesson from this entire saga so that when another terrorist group emerge in other parts of the world, we do not see the same scenario being repeated again.
Well, I'm not really sure what lesson they could learn from this. You know, it's what happened to the people in Central Asia is the same thing that happened to people from countries all over the world. I mean, people went for an assortment of reasons. And actually, you gave me an opportunity to ask a question that I wanted to ask our guests, too, is that, you know, in some places we've seen that it's people that for whatever reason believed that had a religious duty or something. There was something there that they thought was a call that they should have to listen to, you know, that had to do with their faith. But yet when we saw the, you know, when I was watching Shahida's film, one of the young women said she didn't know anything about Islam at all. Really, you know, she went because her husband went. And then we've heard that, you know, from both our guests, that seems to be the case. So I'm really kind of curious. I don't know what the governments can do in Central Asia. But I think the interesting thing is how much of this even had to do, you know, since our guests have interviewed these people and spoken with theologians, how much of this ever had to do with Islam at all, as far as the people who have been returned? I mean, it seems like there's a lot of selfish reasons or reasons of some sense of duty to a husband or something like that. But I don't get the impression that people, you know, equate this or see that this was part of some religious duty, at least the people that we've been talking about, with the women and stuff. That doesn't seem to be why they went. It's because they thought that this was their duty under Islam to do. They had other entirely different reasons for going, you know, and so I was curious about that.
Anyone to respond to this?
Well, I totally agree with this point. Actually, I have a book about exactly that. Religion is something they use to basically cover everything else. So, for example, let's take, if we're talking about Kazakhstan. Kazakhstan had one of the biggest groups in, like, Katiba's units inside ISIS for foreign fighters. It was huge. It was like 1,500, gigantic. So who do you think, who was the leader, who was an Amir? Let's call him Amir. You know, they call him Amir, religious name, right? Now, of this group. And our religious leader of Kazakh Jamaat in ISIS just happened to be a former smatrashi on Shymkent. Smatrashi is like a criminal word for the guy being in charge of criminal life of the city. So I'm not, you know, like, how can you get from smatrashi to Amir? It's a very big stretch to me, right? But he happened to also have 4 Yazidi slaves, you know, everything that comes with a nice upgrade from smatrashi in Shymkent to Amir in Kazakh Jamaat in ISIS. And there were a lot of them. So if you look at the individual cases, which I did for many, many, many members, I mean, almost all of them have a previous criminal conviction. Majority of them, which is hilarious, at least from Russia, is on drugs. So drug trade. Drug trade racketeering, 2 main criminal charges before they magically decided that, you know, jihad is calling them. So, of course, no wonder, first, there were a lot of drug addicts inside ISIS, right? Because they basically returned to whatever they were doing before, going to beautiful lands of, you know, Iraq and Syria. But also all this stuff was like stealing individual property and they're selling it, buying slaves, and all this basically fun stuff. So when someone of that nature tells me something about Islam and they're like, oh, but I changed when I was doing my third time in prison for drugs, I'm like, wow, you really found God here, right? And then you decided to go to Syria. I mean, you kidding me? Or when we talk about Russians, we have a lot of disproportional number of former neo-Nazis who, again, magically decided that they need to, you know, believe in Islam and go to Syria. But basically, the case is that they could not do whatever they wanted to do when they joined neo-Nazis. For example, killing people on the street. But then there was a great opportunity to do so in Syria. And what do you need to do? Convert to Islam and pray five times a day. Well, not hard. We'll do that. I literally know a person who has a tattoo on his chest. On one side, it's Hitler, and on the other side, it's an ISIS black flag. Like, I mean, what kind of, you know, a religious duty we're talking about here?
Yeah.
And well, now they could only say that because a lot of people, you know, are afraid to kind of deal with this religion, you know, not to offend anyone, you know, we're not discriminative. So they're now extremely pushing about it. First, you know, appealing to the sexist idea of a lot of males in governments, especially in Central Asia and former Soviet Union, by saying, oh my God, I just followed a husband. And of course, you know, a lot of males work in the same KGB, and a lot of males in general in the country, the audience are like, of course she did the right thing. How we could punish her for this nice behavior? And, you know, she said that she did it for God. And a lot of people, again, would be afraid to touch this issue.
But it is not to expand the conversation, but this is also true, isn't it, in Central Asian society, at least in some cases, that those women indeed followed their husband, isn't it? I mean, there might be some radicals.
Well, I congratulate them with them, with that. That's good. But imagine, let's say I'm a wife in some Central Asian country, and my husband happened to sell drugs, right? Just imagine, right? And he tells me to take this package with drugs and bring it to her, his whatever friend, you know, God knows where. And I get arrested in the middle of it. And then, you know, I say, by the way, I mean, what can I do? My husband, it's my husband who asked me to move those drugs there. Oh, I'm not a chemistress, right? I don't know what's in there. It's just a white bag with, you know, something that looks like cocaine. I mean, would you treat me the same way?
It sounds like we are kind of coming back to what we have already discussed. But very lastly, Shahida, on Dr. Mironova's points on how those women should be dealt with versus the way they are being currently treated. You know, in some ways, this has been the culture in Central Asia, right? That women are expected to follow their husbands. While I say this, by no means I endorse this culture. But as a Central Asian, Shahida, you know how the traditional way of family looks like in the region. I'm kind of putting you in an uncomfortable position to respond to Dr. Mironova's points, but how does this argument sounds like from a Central Asian perspective? In many
Mohammed,
cases,
everyone is equal before the law,
yeah,
man or
sure.
woman, respectively. The law should apply to everyone. It's not related to what gender you are. You know, you have to be treated as a separate individual, not an attachment to your husband. So I followed my husband's situation. Doesn't really cut it for me. To be honest, these women went believing in what their husbands were telling them. Now, the level of their religious education, knowledge of Islam was absolute minimal or none at all. You know, and on top of that, and we're talking now in a particular area of Kazakhstan, which is quite dull, quite infrastructurally backward. It's Uralsk, it's Aktobe, it's quite cold there almost half a year of 1 year of 12 months. It's desperate and destitution. Here comes Islamic ideology or some sort of ideology and salvation. And actually the, you know what I call it? The way they, preachers or whatever, I don't even know how to call these people, are explaining religion to them is like McDonald's style. You know, there is five rules, six rules, all you need to know. The way the brainwashing goes is very effective because, okay, you're in a bad situation. Things are bad. The government is bad. The corruption is there. This is your way forward. Here's a leaflet with five things you need to know. And yalla, go do hijrah. You know, we open for you the gates of paradise. And the ignorance in all levels, you know, educational, whatever, plays its role too. So, yes, these women did follow, but they had a choice. And all of them said that they had a choice, but they decided to go because of they were afraid of one thing, another thing, or they decided to follow their husbands. It doesn't make them less criminal than their husbands, from my point of view. And we should be absolutely fair, you know, honest about it. With all the sympathy with all the women who agreed to talk to me, I think they've been through so many things, plus we don't know what they were dealing with, that certain amount of punishment should happen. Mm-hmm. A few of the girls you've seen in the film are now walking around, I mean, doing some lectures and seminars, talking to wider audiences about the dangers of radical Islam. And one of them is enrolled in university to study religion, but this is the minimal. I would say Kazakhstan has a bigger problem of internal radicalization without even returnees from ISIS. And I could see the signs of it in the streets and in the markets, you know, and it's quite worrying. The authorities really have to keep an eye on these returnees, as well as on the internal grooming of these people, of potential, you know, terrorists.
So, yeah, thank you, Shahida. You know, it's been a very eye-opener conversation for the past 1 hour. I know we have so many other things to talk about. Perhaps we could come back to this some other time. But here we need to conclude the discussion. Perhaps you might have some opinion about the final question that I have in mind, Dr. Mironova. So here we are. Some of the Central Asian countries brought back hundreds of their citizens from the Middle East for whatever purpose they had in mind, and they are applying policies that they think fit for their needs, which clearly differ from each other, like Tajikistan having a heavy hand, Uzbekistan not so much, in Kazakhstan somewhere in the middle, and Turkmenistan remaining in darkness as in many other cases. So on top of that, the approach by the authorities seem to be not very effective, as our colleagues have been talking about. In the meantime, things are once more sharply deteriorating in neighboring Afghanistan. Taliban are taking over district after district in the areas bordering Central Asia. And there are hundreds of Central Asian fighters lying low across those bordering towns in Afghanistan. So what I'm saying is, where does this put the region as to what comes next and where our eyes should be going forward?
Well, we actually didn't talk about Kyrgyzstan at all, but like I'm concerned about Kyrgyzstan. Kyrgyzstan is the country where I have the biggest number of male ISIS members walking around freely, because guess why? Any court could be, you know, bought for $15,000. And Kyrgyzstan, you know, they didn't repatriate women yet because they are like discussing and not sure what to do. But I mean, anyone who wanted to come back, males, they already back with the new clean documents and so on for $15,000. And so I'm very not optimistic about the region in general. Because there is no control about ISIS stuff at all. A lot of those countries are too close to Afghanistan, which is now a stronghold. And you know what happened yesterday with Tajikistan. That, by the way, one of the reasons why Tajikistan is like, we're not playing with those, you know, beautiful, lovely ISIS wives. And, you know, we are too close to Afghanistan to be messing with that. But also Afghanistan is too close. They could go there. There is no control. And the countries, as Shahida said, they have been coming more Islamic themselves. I remember in Uzbekistan, there is already a discussion about separate education between boys and girls. So, of course, you know, what kind of a following law we could say if, you know, some countries are getting more radicalized by themselves, you know, from the head of the fish. So I'm extremely concerned. Plus, even I'm concerned for other countries, because, as you know, a lot of terrorist attacks or planned terrorist attacks in Europe were done by folks from Central Asia, right? I'm not talking about the big one, the loudest one, like Paris. But former Soviet Union is all over there, including, you know, Russia, also Central Asia and Russia, right? The Uzbek guy in Stockholm, the Chechen guy in France. Now, five Tajiks who are planning to do an attack in Germany. And by the way, three of those five Tajiks were on Tajikistan wanted list when they were... They still managed somehow to get to Germany. Istanbul, right? Istanbul attack on an airport. Although it was run by a Chechen with Georgian citizen, right? All perpetrators were from Central Asia, Kyrgyzstan, Uzbekistan. So I'm extremely... of course, United States. Our beautiful Uzbek truck driver who drove his truck into the crowd. So, I mean, it's not a Central Asia problem. It's a gigantic problem now for the whole world. And Central Asia is failing epically.
It's a major problem. But on Central Asia, though, Bruce, perhaps you would like to jump in here. You know, we have been so far criticizing Central Asian authorities that they are having heavy hand on anything religion, perhaps overusing ideology as a pretext to even crack down against their own opponents. And there is no shortage of examples like that. And now, in this conversation, some of our colleagues have criticized Central Asian authorities for not having a heavy-handed approach on, at least in the context of those returnees from Syria. So where we stand and where the region stands in this long-standing question going forward?
Yeah, I mean, listening to our guests, I would have to say that they might have underestimated the threat from this one. You know, it's, again, it's always been strange to me that these people seem to vanish when they get into the countries. You know, you don't hear anything good or bad about them. And I suppose that, you know, you ask, like, where my eyes will be at waiting for one of these apparently ticking time bombs that they've let loose in the country to go off and bring attention back to who they brought home from these areas. I mean, hopefully that won't happen, but it sounds like it's inevitable in one of these countries sooner or later that one of these people is who hasn't really repented or been rehabilitated is going to do something and draw attention to, unfortunately, everybody that's been brought back. And I know the governments in the region have gotten some rare positive international praise for, you know, taking this step and bringing these people back. But, you know, again, judging from the conversation, listening to our guests, I'd have to say, you know, it seems like it's only a matter of time until one person at least shows that they haven't been successful in rehabilitating some people.
Okay. Very briefly, Shahida, where your eyes will be, I mean, as someone who just did this project with a fresh eye on this problem, so where your eyes going to be in immediate future as to how things will develop going forward from here?
Well, I would love to really get to Uzbekistan and find out what happens to the women and children returned to Uzbekistan. Because these stories we don't know about. You know, we've heard a lot, but the Uzbeks were this community and there were a lot of them, a lot. And I want to hear this story, you know. I want to follow up and see what's happening. But me as a documentary filmmaker, I'm not an analyst. I'm an observer. And that's exactly what Bruce said. My job was to go and find out what happened afterwards. I'm just documenting whatever is happening. And we'll see. We'll see. It's very difficult to predict, and I'm not in the prediction business. So I'm just stating what is obvious.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It's amazing how time flies. I wasn't expecting this discussion to last that long. But, you know, anyhow, it was a great conversation, and it was great to listen to your perspectives. But let's end the conversation here. Thank you very much, Dr. Vera Mironova, the research fellow at the Harvard University, Shahida Tuliganova, award-winning documentary filmmaker and the author of The Second Chance, the documentary that we discussed about today, about the ISIS returnees to Kazakhstan, and Bruce Panier, the editor of Radio Free Liberty Central Asia blog, Kishlok Owasi. Again, thank you. Thank you very much, colleagues, for your time and thoughts today. And this is from me, Mohammed Tahir, Radio Free Pretty Liberties Media Manager and host of the Majlis podcast here in Washington, D.C. Until next week, bye-bye.